This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with our President's Day episode, a series of interviews with authors who have new books out. And our next author is David M. Rubenstein. He's the co-founder and co-executive chairman of the Carlyle Group, and he's the host of the David Rubenstein Show on Bloomberg TV and PBS. The book, The American Story: Conversations with Master Historians. And you probably recognize some of the names that he profiles in this book, some very well-known biographers and some very well-known Americans. Our producer, Elise Meckler, talked with David Rubenstein earlier in this pre-recorded interview.
David Rubenstein, thank you so very much for joining us.
My pleasure to be here.
Tell me a little bit about your book, The American Story: Conversations with Master Historians.
About 6 years ago, I started a program to help educate members of Congress more about American history on the theory that who should know more about American history than the people making our laws. So once a month for the last 6 years or so, I've interviewed a great American historian like David McCullough, Doris Kearns Goodwin, John Meacham, Ron Chernow, in front of members of Congress at a dinner that I host with the Library of Congress. And so I've taken 16 of these interviews and put them in a book in an interview format. So you can see the questions that I asked and the answers that were given with a little summary of the interview that I did in the front of each interview. And the interviews are quite interesting because they give you a good look at presidents like Washington or Lincoln or FDR. But it's interesting that these interviews are done in a way where members of Congress come and I ask them to sit with people from the opposite party in the opposite house. So while the era of good feelings hasn't exactly broken out in Washington, I do think that there is a truce when these dinners are held, and members of Congress regard it as one of the most interesting things they do in Congress. So that's what the book is about.
Tell me a little bit about some of the various chapters. I found it fascinating going into the lives of all of these presidents and dignitaries. What was your favorite?
Well, Doris Kearns Goodwin talking about Abraham Lincoln is hard to top, there's no doubt. Scott Berg talking about Lindbergh is hard to top because he's such a good raconteur as well as a writer. He won the Pulitzer Prize for that book. One of the people that I interviewed was John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the United States. Now, you might say, why would he be there? Because he's not a historian. Well, here's what actually happened. I'm the chairman of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. He's the chancellor, so we worked closely together over the last several years. And I thought it would be a good idea if members of Congress could hear how the Supreme Court actually works. So at the beginning, I said to him in the interview, would you tell me, did you always want to be Chief Justice of the United States? He said, no. I said, did you want to be a judge when you were a little boy? No. Did you want to be a lawyer when you were a little boy? No. What did you want to be? I wanted to be a historian. That's all I cared about, American history. My father said to me, John Roberts said, there's no money in being a historian. You write books nobody ever read. So find something else. And John said, no, I'm going to be a historian. So while he was at Harvard, he majored in history, came back from his spring break, came to Logan Airport, got off, got in a cab, said to the cab driver, take me to Harvard. Cab driver said, are you a student at Harvard? Yes, I am. What are you majoring in? I'm majoring in history. Cab driver said, well, when I was a student at Harvard, that's what I majored in also. All of a sudden, John realized maybe his father was right. So he did become a lawyer.
You also had, you described sort of your interest in documents of history, how you personally have collected. How did you end up with the Magna Carta?
Well, it's hard to believe that you can own the Magna Carta, but it turns out there's one in private hands. What happened is this. The Magna Carta, which we all know about, the original one was in 1215, but there were other versions in 1217, 1224, 1297. There are 17 extant copies of the Magna Carta. They're roughly 800 years old. And one of them was in private hands, owned by a family for 500 years. They went land poor in the early 1980s. Ross Perot bought it. He ultimately decided to sell it. It was sold through Sotheby's. I went to an auction. I heard it was going to be sold to somebody from outside the United States. I decided we should have one copy in the United States because it was the inspiration for our Declaration of Independence and to some extent for our Bill of Rights. So I bought it. I put it on permanent loan to the National Archives, and it'll be there forever.
And you also have a Declaration of Independence, is that correct? Or a version, copy?
I have there's a thing called the stone copy of the Declaration, which is a perfect replica that was done in 1823 at the order of the Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, to make certain that Americans could see what the original looked like, because the original was fading. And I own about 10 of these copies, and they're relatively rare. I put them on display at places like the Smithsonian, Mount Vernon, the National Constitution Center, National Archives, and places like that, so Americans can see them. Why do I care about that? Americans know very little of our history. Three-quarters of Americans, 75%, cannot even name the three branches of government. It turns out now one-third of Americans cannot even name one branch of government. And so that's because we don't teach history very much anymore. We don't teach civics anymore. And it turns out that in 49 out of 50 states, people born in this country cannot pass the basic citizenship test that naturalized citizens have to pass in order to become citizens. So I'm trying to do more to kind of educate people about our history, because if you don't know about your history, you can't avoid the mistakes of the past. The theory of history is we should learn how civilization did things right and did things wrong, and let's avoid the things civilization did wrong in the past and do things better in the future. But you can't know that if you don't know what our history is.
And some of those lessons are found in the stories that you tell, along with the historians. For example, there are stories that I had never heard of. Let's go through some of them. John Adams and David McCullough and John Adams. What hadn't been talked about till now?
Well, in John Adams' case, he was the second president of the United States, the first vice president, but relatively little known in recent years because he wasn't as idolized as Thomas Jefferson or George Washington or Benjamin Franklin. So David McCullough wrote a book about him a number of years ago, won the Pulitzer Prize. It's now in its probably 78th or 79th printing. And he showed what John Adams had done to help the Revolution. He was the principal person responsible for the resolution that the Continental Congress passed that said we should break away from England. He helped negotiate the final treaty that ended the war. He also was a very, very good president, though he was controversial. He didn't get reelected. But he was a man who I think is one of our great founding fathers, even though there is no memorial to him or statue in Washington, D.C.
You know, and you also write that there was a lot written about John Adams because he wrote a lot to his wife, whereas Thomas Jefferson, not so much. What did you learn about Thomas Jefferson?
Well, let me explain. John Adams was married to Abigail for quite some time, and they had 1,000 letters, at least that we have, between them. And Abigail Adams, while not an educated person, wrote letters that are brilliant and show great insight. And she wrote a famous letter to John Adams during the Continental Congress saying, please remember the women, which the men, of course, did not do when they were setting up the country. Women in the early days of our country could not own property if they were married. Obviously, they couldn't vote, and they also couldn't hold office. So the men were not that worried about the women. Thomas Jefferson, we have about 20,000 of his letters extant. He had an elaborate way of when he wrote a letter, he had a pen that kind of duplicated what he was writing, so he kept a copy of everything he was writing. So we have a lot of his letters. But he never in his letters does he talk about a woman that he had a relationship with, Sally Hemings. His wife died when Thomas Jefferson was 39 years old, so there are very few letters that exist between Thomas and his wife, Martha. The relationship with Sally Hemings went on for some 30 years. Why did it happen? Well, lots of speculation, but interestingly, the father of Thomas Jefferson's wife, Martha, that man, John Wares, was also the father of Sally Hemings, because Sally Hemings was the product of a slave owner impregnating a slave, which was very common in those days. And the result was Sally Hemings, who was three-quarters white. And so when Thomas Jefferson saw her at 16 years old, the theory is that he was seeing a young version of his wife, and he developed a relationship with her, with it produced six children, four of whom survived to adulthood.
And you also write about Alexander Hamilton with Ron Chernow. And as everybody knows, Hamilton, big famous musical. What didn't we know that your book sort of touches upon?
Alexander Hamilton was relatively unknown as a founding father, and that is why Ron Chernow wrote the book that later Lin-Manuel turned into this famous play and musical. Alexander Hamilton was an illegitimate child. He kind of came in from the Virgin Islands, came to the United States with no money, and basically very quickly, while a student at Columbia University, what's now Columbia University, became an aide to George Washington during the Revolutionary War, worked his way up to become ultimately a Secretary of Treasury and the closest confidant on political and governmental matters to George Washington. A brilliant man, though not so brilliant as to avoid a duel where he was killed by Aaron Burr at the age of 49. Had he lived till his 80s, as John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin did, he would have probably become better known, because those who lived longer wrote books about how great they were, and Alexander Hamilton didn't really have a chance to do that. Ron Chernow ultimately did it for him.
And you also touch upon two other presidents, Richard Nixon, Bob Woodward, talking about Richard Nixon. Explain a little bit
about... Bob Woodward was a young reporter, I think 29 years old, when he was asked to investigate a break-in at the Watergate office building. And ultimately, this led to the resignation of Richard Nixon. In all the years after Richard Nixon resigned, Bob Woodward tried to get a meeting with or talk to Richard Nixon. It never happened. So Bob Woodward, who's linked with Richard Nixon, never actually talked to him or met with him. But it was his dogged research which proved that Richard Nixon had engaged in conduct that was inappropriate and led to his resignation. Richard Nixon kept the famous tapes, Bob Woodward speculates, because Richard Nixon wanted to have a good record of his administration so he could write a book about it and not be contradicted by Henry Kissinger or others who might be taking credit for things that Richard Nixon wanted to do. Had Richard Nixon destroyed the tapes, he would not have been impeached or convicted, almost certainly. If it had gone to a trial, he would have been convicted. But that was because he didn't believe the Supreme Court would overturn what he would regard as precedent and take away presidential tapes.
You also talk about Alexander Butterfield. Explain who he was and why that was so key at the moment, at the time.
Alexander Butterfield was a low-level assistant, really, to Bob Haldeman, who was the chief of staff. And Butterfield was the person who, in a interrogation by the Senate Watergate Committee, said in private, yes, there were tapes at the White House. That was a bombshell. He was quickly brought in front of the public, and he revealed there had been a taping system. At the second that that had happened, if Richard Nixon had destroyed all the tapes on the argument that they were had national security secrets and so forth, almost certainly he would have survived. Alexander Butterfield is a man who was interviewed by Bob Woodward just a few years ago when a book came out and described how his life was affected by his innocently revealing in an interview that he was aware of the tapes. And obviously that changed the course of history, because without the tapes, Richard Nixon would have survived.
When you look at these presidents and you look at today, what are the lessons on President's Day that people should walk away from and look at?
Well, I think the lessons are that we've had 45 individuals serve as President of the United States. Some are extraordinarily smart, some are not as smart, some are great patriots, some are maybe less enamored with certain things that are called patriotism. But they all have very unique qualities, and I think all of them were interested in doing the best thing for the country as they saw it. Some were unsuccessful, some were very successful. But I think you have to think that we were very fortunate to have people like George Washington or Abraham Lincoln serve as presidents in our country, because these men made a real, real difference. And hopefully, over the next 200-plus years of our country's history, we'll have other talented people who say, yes, I'd like to be president, and hopefully we'll finally have a woman who is elected to do so.
You have a chapter sort of dedicated to the wives of the presidents.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that.
Cokie Roberts, who passed away just a few months ago, wrote three books about the women of the early part of our country's history, during the Revolutionary War and during the Civil War. And in the early part of our country, women were not allowed to own property if they were married. They had to own everything in their husband's name, or their husbands had to own it. They weren't allowed to hold office, and of course they couldn't vote. So that was a different world than the world we live in. But women were quite influential, because we know through the letters that they wrote, and they wrote really, really extraordinary letters, that they had a lot of influence on their husbands, because a lot of the communication, a lot of the work was done behind the scenes at social gatherings that were organized by the women. And the women tended to be kind of message carriers between the various principals and families. And so they had a lot of influence. And Cokie Roberts' three books reveal how interesting these women were, how smart they were, and how influential they were, even though they weren't written very much about. You know, we call what I'm talking about history, H-I-S, story, his story. But if women had written the stories, they might have been called her story. But we really don't have a lot of her stories, because a lot of the histories were written by men, and they wrote about men. But if there had been more Cokie Roberts, we'd know a lot more about the women who had influence in our country's history.
And what's your next project after this?
Well, I have a TV show on Bloomberg and PBS where I interview great leaders from around the world. And I have a book that will come out in September, also published by Simon & Schuster, of the interviews of these people focusing on leadership. What does it take to be a leader? How do people become leaders? Why are some people great leaders? Why are some people not great leaders? And that'll be my next book project.
You know, I also walked away with, there was great points about leadership in this. For each person you profiled had a philosophy of leading. What was the moment that you most admired?
In my view, of the 45 people who have served as President of the United States, there is one who stands out above all of them, and that's Abraham Lincoln. It isn't evident to me that any other person would have been able to hold the Union together. He was not well-educated. He was relatively unknown when he became president. Many southern states seceded, and he decided to hold the Union together. Many other people might have said to the South, goodbye, go away, we'll have our own country without you. But he decided to keep the Union together, and while we have the tragedies of the Civil War, 600,000 men and women were killed during it, ultimately we ended slavery, and ultimately we kept the country together. And I think Lincoln was able to do that in a way that no other person would have. So he stands above everybody else as a great leader, in my view.
Thank you so much for speaking with us. The name of the book is The American Story, Conversations with Master Historians. It is by David Rubenstein. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Up next, we talk with the author of a new book that looks at 100 years of women's suffrage and the battle that led to that right to vote. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.